everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today. It is a chilly November 5th. The weather just is doing what it always does, getting cooler. And that's okay, just as long as you have what you need to stay warm and dry and cozy. And I hope you are warm and dry and cozy at this moment, and you can sit back and relax and listen to this hour where we talk about my favorite subject, food. I wanted to let you know, before we get started with today's guest, that I happen to be the featured force on the website The Blooming Platter, theBloomingPlatter.com, and you may remember, not sure when it was, but I interviewed Betsy DeJulio, who's the author of a cookbook, The Blooming Platter, a beautiful book, and she has a website, theBloomingPlatter.com, and she recently started a vegan Q&A Tuesday. It's kind of based on James Lipton's famous Q&A on the Inside the Actor's Studio. You might be familiar with that. But it was kind of fun. She gave me some questions. I answered them. And you can see my responses at thebloomingplatter.com. So if you go there, let me know what you think. And you can check out the other featured forces. Last month was Brianna, I think it was Brianna Grogan. I'm looking on the website here, and let's see. Oh, well, you can check it out on your own. Oh, yeah, it was Brianna Clark Grogan, and then Robin Robertson, and then me, and next month will be Nava Atlas, and then Laura Theodore, all lovely women who love the kind of food that I love. All right. Let's move on to my first guest, Tina Lee, who is the founder of Oat Health and author of Balance Raw and Superfood Juices and Smoothies. She's passionate about raising the bar on wellness and uses a variety of holistic services to support small businesses and individuals in achieving whole being transformation. She's a therapeutic chef, certified holistic health practitioner and author, public speaker, and entrepreneur. We're going to be talking about her book, Balanced Raw. Welcome to It's All About Food, Tina.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here today.
Oh, thank you. Now, lately I've been asking a lot of guests if I pronounce their name correctly, so I'm going to ask you, is it Lee? Is it Lay? How do you pronounce your name?
Lee.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ding, I got it right.
I'll answer to both, but it's Lee.
Okay, good. And then is it Oat Health?
Oat Health or Hot Health, depending really on where you are in the world. In Europe, it might be Hot, and here we refer to it as Hot. So H-A-U-T-E can be either way.
Oh, so how is it? Does it have a different meaning? I'm taking the French version of it as High Health.
Haute health as, yes, like haute couture, high fashion, high couture, the same thing for nutrition, yes.
Okay. I speak French, so I don't like pronouncing the H. I just wondered what Americans do with those words.
Yeah, okay. Sometimes it just comes out as hot.
Okay, hot health, whatever. It's a great name, and you have a website. However you want to say it, oathealthnow.com, oathealthnow.com.
Yes.
And you don't have to know how to say it. You just need to go there, visit, and learn the secrets to happy, delicious living, right?
That's right. Thank you.
Good. All right. So briefly, just give us a little bit of your story. How did you get here from wherever?
Sure. It's been quite a journey, but the short version is years ago, I had a lot of illnesses as a child and well into my 20s. And living in the Western world, I adopted Western medicine and went the conventional route and ended up amassing huge medical bills that were with no end in sight in covering those. You could name every illness that I would somehow get it. And these conditions got so severe, and I just got really fed up and decided that I needed to do something radical at that time to shake things up. And I adopted more of Eastern philosophy, which is a lot about bringing harmony and balance back into the body, right? So Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, things of that nature, bringing nutrition into the picture is what ultimately helped me heal. It was a long recovery, but a path that along the way I discovered I wasn't alone, and there were many people like me who had conditions and illness and just dis-ease that our Western medical system wasn't addressing in its entirety. And that is where I was inspired to go down the path that I have to help bring this message to the masses and to stimulate awareness around the importance of clean eating and the importance of clean thinking and mindful eating and mindful living. And along the way, I was able to write both on my blog and the book Balanced Raw and my latest Superfood Juices and Smoothies. And that's where I'm at now, is promoting those and working with clients that come via those materials.
Well, that's great. And what I like to do on this show, I talk a lot about food, obviously. It's all about food. And often I bring on different people who have had individual experiences, a health crisis of one or another, and found that foods were a big piece of their getting well. And I think it's important to hear all of the individual stories, because everybody that's listening, they might relate to one or another, or have a relative or a friend that's experiencing something specific. And sometimes, well, when we talk about how healthy foods, a healthy diet can reduce the risk of every chronic disease, people may not get it. They may not relate to it. They need to hear an individual story of somebody who had something like they experienced and latch on to that. So your story is important. Your work is important. And, of course, we need everybody talking about this. I'm looking at a Bizarro.com cartoon, if you're familiar with Bizarro. And somebody just sent it to me today, but it's a guy in a white coat in a classroom, and it's entitled First Day of Med School. And he's pointing to the blackboard, and it says, "Preventative medicine kills return business." So there you were. You were going through conventional medicine here in the Western world, and it wasn't solving any of your problems, and your bills just kept getting bigger and bigger.
Because
that's return business.
Exactly. And it's the common suffering in our culture here in America. Feel that you know, like I said, I wasn't alone. The listeners recognize they're not alone. They may feel like it sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Are there names for some of the specific things that you had?
Sure. At 18 years old, I was diagnosed with melanoma that came out of seemingly nowhere. So that was the biggest one. Mm-hmm. I'll go big and then work backwards. and I had really severe ulcerative colitis in my digestion, completely screwed up. I had been on Accutane, unfortunately, for 3 years straight, that I was never advised to not be on it. And it eradicates your healthy digestion, really.
All the good flora.
It destroys
gone.
Villi and all of the bacteria. Yeah, exactly. And I had really chronic rashes and kind of hive skin conditions that would occur frequently. I was highly allergic to a lot of environmental factors, be that smoke, perfumes. Things would make my throat tighten up if I came across a perfume or any sort of paint, fumes of paint, gasoline. I was just really highly sensitive to, I shouldn't say allergic, highly sensitive to these environmental toxins.
You know, that's a good thing you bring up. Well, people don't realize, especially those that are highly allergic or allergic to different things, what they don't realize is when their body is already inflamed from eating the wrong foods, you're going to be more sensitive to your environment. And if you clean all of that up, you get rid of the inflammation, and that may or may not get rid of all your allergies, but it will definitely reduce them.
Absolutely, and that goes for environmental as well as food allergies and sensitivities, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, but not enough people talk about that, so I'm glad you brought that up. And now you're beautiful and healthy in and out, right?
Well, thank you. And I will say I feel better now than I have ever felt in my life. And a lot of it has to do with, like you're describing here, the foods we eat, what we put into our body, and how we digest and assimilate that is essential. And so, you know, we want to make sure that we're eating the foods at our individual level that are most absorbable and assimilated in our unique constitution. So there's a lot of diets, again, in our Western culture that are like the one answer. It's the one diet, the single diet that's going to solve everybody's problems, make them feel better and not have illness. But what works for you isn't necessarily going to work for me, and that's where Balanced Raw comes in, because it addresses the individual, which is really essential in this, in the healing process, or just in healthy living altogether.
Okay, so on one hand, we're not alone, because there are all kinds of people out there that are experiencing ridiculous health problems, very severe, very serious, that food can definitely help. But on the other hand, we're all unique. Not alone,
true.
But unique, and plant foods can work for us individually in wonderful ways.
Yes, yeah. And there's some finesse, really, in discovering what that looks like for us. And clean plant foods have a tremendously high vibration compared to those that are denatured and harder to digest, which would be animal proteins. But those are that are easy, more easily digestible, we find that it does elevate our internal vibration and our ability for our bodies to heal themselves.
Now, that's an interesting concept, vibration, and it's not something that current science talks about a lot or has a lot of evidence for, but I think we'll be learning a lot more about it in the future as our science becomes more sophisticated, because there are definitely things that we don't know about. And energy is very, very magical, and there's a lot of mystery involved, and I look forward to learning more about it, because we are all energy. And it's important that we consume the right kind of energy that works with us, not against us. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so you've written a 4-week program, Balanced Raw.
Yeah.
So can we just touch on what goes on in those 4 weeks?
Yes, of course. So the very first week is all about elimination and getting the junk out of the diet, which would be processed food, those ridden with chemicals. And I even spell out some of those chemicals that are really common that that are highly toxic, you know, your aspartames, for example. And I go into what those are in a list format, as well as what they cause in our bodies, the inflammation or the disease that they cause. And so this first week is all about getting that out of your pantry, getting it out of your house and out of your eating environment, and finding those ingredients and foods that are more healthful and nutritive alternatives that you can bring into the eating environment so that they're at the forefront of your experience and accessible to you always, whereas the other ones are removed. It also talks about eliminating those foods that are more difficult to digest and break down, like we were just mentioning, animal proteins, for example, and getting the body prepared for a more cleansing experience. It's always nice to ease into a cleanse or a detox, and this is that easing period.
Now, when we talk about elimination, that means getting rid of things out of the body, and then they have to come out. And a lot of people don't like to talk about that part of it. But whenever we change our diet, whether it's a good diet or a bad diet, our bowels change, our movements change. And that can be kind of shocking to people. I mean, it can be, and it, as you said before, we're all unique, and our response can be dramatically different.
For sure. I'm glad you bring that up, Karen. And I go address that in the book, too, things to be aware of. So that we're not frightened if we are, you know, frequently eliminating waste, or we're stopped up for a little while, and what you can do to balance either situation to make it more comfortable for you to go through the process, but also how to learn to accept that that is part of the natural process. Because, like you said, it can be scary or uncomfortable, and if somebody's not prepared either emotionally or just with information, they may stop the program or they may go a different direction because it, you know, they just weren't ready.
So, you know, I don't think we mentioned this before, but this book is a mix of raw foods and minimally processed cooked plant foods. It's not 100% raw foods, and that's what you mean by balanced raw.
Right. Yes.
And that's important, and we can talk more about that. I just wanted to say that I was talking to somebody this week who wanted to know more about healthy food, and one thing that he was doing was going to a raw food restaurant, and for 3 days was buying different dishes there to do a cleanse. And I was asking him a number of questions because there's a lot of wonderful raw food restaurants out there, but some of them, in order to satisfy people, in order to make them feel full and sated, their dishes are full of nuts, oil, and salt. And you feel full and then kind of sick afterwards sometimes because it's too rich. So people can be really confused about what raw food is. Just like any diet, there's a wide range of what's considered raw, and it's not all ideal.
Yeah. That's, again, glad you bring that up. That's basically chapter one of the book is all about the fats and concentrated fats. So that's our oils. And what happens when we eat too much fat, as well as when we consume oils that have been sitting on a shelf, which they do in a cafe, in a restaurant, or on the shelf at the grocery store, they become toxic because they're oxidizing when exposed to heat, light, air, and we then are eating, through those kinds of oils and concentrated fats, toxins, when it would serve us better to have the whole fat, be it an avocado or, you know, the fat from a coconut or the fat from nuts and seeds, in moderation, so that we're not overdoing it. A nut pate or a nut spread at a traditional raw restaurant can give us a week's worth of fat in one serving. You know,
oops.
It's pretty unreal, and you're right. It's
delicious,
and it's sating, and it's, you know, it's all of those things that we, that make us feel good, but it's good temporarily. And then you get this block up traffic jam in the digestive system because it's too much for it to process. It cannot process that much fat at once or that much protein at once. And then you have that issue of digestibility again.
You know, you mentioned aspartame, which is one of those horrible, evil things out there, and so many people consume it in their diet foods and their diet drinks. And I just like to repeat this as often as I can because most people don't realize that aspartame increases your appetite.
Mm-hmm.
And if people are drinking diet sodas because they don't want to have the calories, they don't realize that it's a vicious circle and it makes you want to eat more. And it's also wreaking havoc on your body because it's not something that's meant to be in your body.
Yeah. Thank you for mentioning that. I think that's the case for so many chemicals. They're chemicals. They stimulate a neurological reaction and
they're man-made. Other reactions. They're man-made chemicals.
Right. They're supposed to be in there. They're in there to stimulate desire to eat them more.
Yeah. Exactly. Return business.
Precisely. I'm liking that cartoon.
Yeah. It's just funny that I got it today. Well, people know what I'm interested in, so they're always sending me fun things. Okay, what happens week two?
Yeah, so week two, once you've eliminated, we move into the detox and cleansing phase. And it's light. It's a lot of blended soups, easily digestible.
I'm looking at the cooling sweet pea and mint soup. That looks yummy.
It's so good. And it can be served warm this time of year since it's getting a little chillier.
Mm-hmm.
You could have that warmed. And there's some smoothies in here. There's other tonics and light salads that are more easily digestible. And so you learn in the second week what sort of nutrients really help facilitate deeper cleansing, and that's, you know, dandelion root or milk thistle or glutathione and sulfur. It talks about those, and those nutrients are actually in the dishes of these recipes to support that week. It also goes into talking about detoxing steps, things that help you, as I was just mentioning, with what happens if I'm pooping more or not enough, or, I'm tired or fatigued or have a headache because I'm detoxing. It
mm-hmm.
talks about all ways to kind of make it through it with grace, if you will. And then the recipes. And then it's a nice segue into chapter three, which is really exciting. It's week three, not chapter three, week three. And that's reintroducing some cooked foods into the diet because in week two, you take the cooked foods out. And week three is restoring those. And it also gives you a whole section on how to test for food allergens and food sensitivities at home, where through certain evaluation questions, you're able to discover, does this food disrupt my, is it disrupting my well-being? And I give examples of what to test on particular days and make notes of it in a journal so you can check down the list and say, wow, find it interesting that as I reintroduced corn into my diet or soy into my diet or peanuts into my diet or any other common allergen, what was my body's response?
Mm-hmm. You know, we have to take responsibility, and our doctors can't know everything about us. Only we know how we feel inside.
Yeah, and it's really important. You know, we can go to a naturopath, for example, or another doctor and get a food allergy panel, and those I've had it done myself a couple of times, and so have many of my clients, and they serve us well as a guide. But what this part, most of what this book is about and my message to listeners and clients is that's all really great material to work with, but it's not the end answer. The end answer is within and what our body is telling us, and it will tell us before a blood test will, if something isn't working mm-hmm. within our constitution. And so this teaches us how to check in. And it's not only for common food allergens, but to be aware whenever we are eating, how do I feel afterwards? Am I sluggish? Am I congested? Did I not sleep as well? did I not poop normally? Did I have gas or bloating? So it gets us to, you know, this section of the book anyway, really talks about that. And it's a great guide for learning how to listen to what our bodies are wanting to tell us.
And the only way you're going to know is if you write things down, because our memories are not that good. And you might have a symptom and say, I think I had this yesterday. That must have been it. And we really have no way of knowing unless we really carefully watch for the trends and write things down.
Absolutely. And it evolves over time, right? What's not working for me today may work tomorrow. And it changes with our stress factors in life, level of anxiety, how much rest we're getting, what are we eating, where are we living, what's the climate, what's the time of day. I mean, these are all variables that it's a lot to think about when you're beginning this kind of lifestyle. It becomes second nature once you've been doing it a while.
Now, people like to snack, and in week three, you've got kale chips and you've got parsnip chips. Say that three times fast, parsnip chips.
I'll let you say it three times fast.
So much better than anything you can find in the store in a bag with oil and salt and a lot of manipulation. This is just real food.
Yep. There's another one in there, too, for the sweeter side. I'm more of the salty snack person, but I do like the occasional sweet, and there's some lemon bars in there that are just super yummy. They're tangy with fresh lemon juice, and there's a little undertone of vanilla, and they're sweetened with dates. And so you get a whole sugar as opposed to, you know, a concentrated syrup like agave or something.
Right. Very good. Now, you talk a bit about water, and, you know, we cannot forget how important water is. We're made up mostly of water, and a lot of times that's the simplest cure to what ails us. You know, we could be feeling so many things, and it's because we are dehydrated.
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, by the time we're thirsty, we're dehydrated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you talk about what we should do with water. Drink it, of course.
Drink it. I talk about, as kind of a guideline, if you will, and if this isn't entirely backed by enough science, but in experience with many people that I've worked with and all of the research that I have done, usually half your weight in ounces, you know, so... That's a good barometer for the day, and you want it to be filtered clean water. And if that means purchasing a filter for your home, absolutely. If that means buying filtered bottled water, way better than tap, because I talk about all of the different toxins that are in our water supply, unfortunately, and we don't want to be drinking those. And if we can attach a filter to our shower, that's also a great idea, because our skin, being our largest organ, is absorbing all of those toxins as well. So, I do go into that.
Don't forget, our skin is our largest organ, and everything's going in. You know, it's so easy to forget these things. Now, I know what most people say, and this is the last thing I want to talk about before I let you go, because we're almost at the end of the half hour. Too much work, people go. Too much. This is too much trouble. I hear this all the time. I'm very passionate about this. I personally think that, you know, if you want to feel great, and my listeners know I'm always saying this, you don't know how good you can feel. But everything takes time, takes effort, and what do you counsel your clients? How do you motivate them to want to dig in and do what's necessary?
Yeah, a couple of things. First is what I mentioned before. It is a process, and it starts out being a little bit bumpy and effort, but it becomes second nature over time. It really does. That's the first thing. Second of all, get the support, whether that be get your family on track with whatever the intention is to, you know, elevate your eating experience and your lifestyle. try your best to not go it alone, and invite those that are friends and family to join in the effort with you, and then also look to, you know, resources that resonate with you and that you do what you can. I just recently had a woman who bought the book and was doing the program with her husband, and they were getting just the most resounding results and updating me frequently on my Facebook and otherwise. And, you know, she would send me text messages and say, I'm traveling and I, you know, there's only this restaurant in this small town. Can I eat there? You know, and my message back was, you do what you can,
mm-hmm.
because the stress alone will make us sick.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do the best you can as often as you can. And that's huge in my guidance, because we will lose our minds if we just try to do it all so perfect all the time. We're human. We're going to celebrate. We're going to imbibe. We're going to enjoy things, right? You know, so that's the other piece, is do what you can, you know, and don't force yourself to do more than you can keep up with. And as you do that week after week, month after month, you will find you'll just be in a completely different experience after a while.
Tina, thank you very much for joining me on It's All About Food with Balanced Raw.
Thank you, Karen. It's been great.
Thank you. And visit HoteHealthNow.com for more on Tina and her information. Okay, have a great day. We're going to take a little break. I just wanted to mention, during the break, maybe you'll go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my website. And I wanted to recommend scrolling down a little bit on the right-hand column to where it says real water, water made wonderful. I think we talked about water, and it's so important to have clean water. And I distill my water. And I found a company that makes distillers in the United States. This is a rare thing, having something made in the United States. But if you click on that link, you'll learn more about that company and their distiller products. I recommend them. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Mark Beekhoff about his new book, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed. Okay, everybody, we're back. You're listening to It's All About Food here on a chilly November 5th, 2013. And now to part two of our program. I'm going to introduce my next guest. Mark Beekhoff is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He has worked alongside leading writers and activists, including Jane Goodall, Peter Singer, and PETA co-founder Ingrid Newkirk. He lives in Boulder, Colorado. That's a very, very, very brief bio, because this man has done many amazing things and written many great books and so much more. Welcome to It's All About Food, Mark.
It's great to be here, Karen. Thanks for having me again.
Yes, thank you so much. I just finished reading Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed.
Yeah.
And I was very excited to find out about it, because I did not know that you were writing a blog column on Psychology Today.
Right.
And it's, well, on one hand, I'm really glad I found it. On the other hand, my book list has just grown by like 1,000 things I now have to read.
Yes. Well, there's a lot out there, but I'm hoping you'll enjoy what I write.
Yeah. So that's what's exciting. There's a lot out there about animals, and I believe that, oh, well, we have this horrible history as humans, I think, where we've done so many terrible things. We do a lot of wonderful things, but we've done some terrible things. And a lot of it just comes from ignorance and not really understanding what we're doing. And we treat fellow humans too often without respect or integrity, and we certainly do that with other non-human animals.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in a minute. We just need to learn, once we open our minds to what's really in front of us, we're just going to soar. And I believe that a lot of the work that you highlight in this book is the beginning of that.
Yeah, I mean, really what the book is all about, I've written about 500 essays for Psych Today, and there's a little more than 100 in there. What I really try to cover are the new and exciting discoveries, like mice displaying empathy, chickens and rats displaying empathy. We've just learned recently that a fish actually uses their head to indicate where there's food. Mm. And in ethology, or the study of animal behavior, we call that referential communication. And it used to be thought that only humans did it, and we know other animals do it now. And so, one thing after another in terms of animal consciousness, animal sentience, animal cognition, animal emotions, and it's just incredible what we're learning about other animals. So that's what I try to do in these essays, just make them digestible to people and, don't compromise on the science, but really present them so that non-scientists can read them.
Humans have had this opinion. I guess I have to include myself in this group. I like to think sometimes that maybe I'm part alien, but maybe not. Anyway, humans have believed that we are the most amazing of all the species, the most superior, the most intelligent, and it's really not a good idea to think that way. And once we get humble and realize that all species have something to offer to this world.
Right. I mean, the bottom line, I say it in the book, is that animals, including human animals, need to do what they need to do to be card-carrying members of their species. And so what that really means is that we do amazing things. And you're right, as you said in the beginning, we do some pretty nasty things, but we do a lot of wonderful things. And so do other animals. And so, we can't fly like birds or hear ultrasound or very low frequency sounds like elephants and whales, but we can do other things. And so really what we're learning in the study of behavior, when you really look at it from a biological point of view, is that, it doesn't get us anywhere to say, oh, dogs are more intelligent than cats or cats are more intelligent than bees. Really what we have to look at is how do they do as members of their own species? And that's what I think is definitely, one of the main messages of my book.
From a psychological point of view, and I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist or any of that, but I do read a lot. A lot of what we do as humans is out of fear. We
Yes.
fear a lot of things, and we do unfortunate things because of that. And when I was reading this book, I kept thinking about the opinions or the feelings that we had towards other humans when people came from Europe to the United States and encountered the Indians. They just thought the Indians were not as civilized. They were barbaric. They just didn't understand their culture, their language, their way of living, and we looked down on them.
Right, and that's exactly what what people do about other animals.
Exactly.
If you don't understand other non-human or human animals, you don't appreciate them, and they become second-class citizens. And then we start assigning value, because when we don't understand something, we fear it. And that's actually a very cogent point, because when we fear other animals, what happens is we treat them differently, and we usually treat them and take advantage of them in order to dominate them. And so one of the things that I try to point out is that, well, sure, we should fear other animals. They can be dangerous. I've had many close encounters with cougars, mountain lions, and black bears. And some of my friends say, oh, that's really cool. And I go, no, there was nothing cool about it at all. but I met them. I'm okay. And where I live, I have these animals, in my neighborhood. And so I just have to take care and respect the fact that I moved into their house, that I like to say I redecorated nature. And so, I really think that what we're learning, that as we learn more and more about animals, that fear will really go, disappear.
there's so many different little tidbits in here, and if you read each article, there's often a link or a recommended reading to learn more about each item. And a few things that stood out for me, I'll just mention them briefly. You mentioned a study about how people who live with cats have a lower risk of heart disease or heart attacks. You had a fascinating article about what's in urine and what fascinates dogs about urine because they're so sensitive to smell and all the things that they learn from it. And I just want to stop there for a minute. That was so fascinating. There's just so much information in urine that dogs take advantage of.
Yes, and so do other animals, you know, like rodents, elephants. And right, and that gets back to the point we were making before, is that animals, you know, do what they need to do to be members of their species. And so if you're a, you know, if you're a cod-carrying dog, you better have a really good sniffer. And
we look at that and we say, oh, that's gross. They're sticking their nose and it's dirty. And but they're decoding, and we could take advantage of that if we could understand what was going on.
Oh, right. I mean, as we learn, you know, about the different sensory modes that animals use, we could use that not only to, you know, learn about them, but also to just basically come to understand how we can treat them better and what they need. And so we all know, you know, if you live with dogs, that certain high-frequency sounds really freak them out. Certain odors really are stressful to them. Birds, you know, male birds especially sing, and when they hear certain songs or certain, you know, noise in their environment, it really can bother them. So I think that as we learn more and more about the natural behavior of these animals, it'll really translate over to how we treat them, how we house them, how we walk them, how we view them. And so, you know, to me, it's a no-brainer that as we're learning more about their behavior, we really, really will also learn more about ourselves. And that's another message in the book of how when we do good things for animals and Earth, we feel good. And when we harm other animals, we really suffer the indignities.
Ah, that reminded me. There, you have many different articles early in the book about dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the unconditional love that dogs give humans. And we most of us know this, but what I loved was you wrote that their giving unconditional love brings love back to them. Their human guardians feel tremendous love for their dog, and that made me think that's all the more reason for all of us to love unconditionally as many people as we possibly can, to put out love, because love comes back.
Yes. A few times in the book, I have the little phrase that compassion begets compassion, and, you know, basically the opposite, violence begets violence. And I was just reading an interesting story about how people who feel really good about themselves tend to display more empathy and compassion for others. And I always tell people, you don't have to worry about running out of compassion credits. I mean, you really don't, because they'll come back at you. And when you get more compassion coming at you, then what happens is you basically then can give it to others. So it's a win-win situation.
So when humans talk about how superior we are, some of the things that are listed are the fact that we use tools and we communicate, and we're learning more about how other animals use tools, and other animals have their own language and way of communicating.
Right. I mean, we know that there's a species of bird called New Caledonian crows who live in New Caledonia, and they fashion and use tools that are more sophisticated than tools that chimpanzees make. And we know that prairie dogs have an incredible language. They basically can use sentences. They have very, very distinct messages they send to one another concerning, like, when a human comes, you know, what they're wearing, who they are, when other animals such as predators are around. And, you know, once again, we're not unique that way. I mean, there's no, you know, animals who speak English or French or any of the human languages, but there's lots of animals that do really amazing things that we can't do, and we do amazing things that they can't do.
One of the things you mentioned a number of times in the book, and this was very moving to me. Most of the book was just like, oh my goodness, there's just so much incredible stuff going on out there we're not paying attention to. We're just too busy focused on our phones. is that different animals grieve and mourn their loss and actually have a version of a funeral.
Yes, I've seen it in magpie birds. Mm-hmm. I've seen it in foxes. It's very commonly observed in elephants, and there's been some recent wonderful videos on the web of chimpanzees. Yeah, I mean, the major point there is that animals recognize a loss. We're not saying they have the same concept of death that we do, because it doesn't seem that they do. But they recognize a loss, and they show respect to the corpse, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We're just seeing it across species now, lots of mammals and birds. And so, you know, it's really just indicating that the animals know something has happened. It doesn't get us anywhere to say bad or good. Of course, a death in humans, we would, you know, cash out as bad. But I'm not sure they do that. I think what they do is they notice that something is going on that hadn't gone on before. They may do it because of an odor. Some people have suggested that, you know, the lack of a sound. We don't really know the mechanism. Mm. But the fact is, they know, if you will, when another animal is really in pain or suffering, and they change their behavior accordingly. And it's just incredible to see. I just got a video from a couple in Canada who saw a funeral ritual in magpies, and that was one of the first ones that I reported years ago. And, you know, the birds stand around, they brought pine needles and twigs, laid them around the body of the dead magpie, and then they all stood around the corpse and almost imperceptibly bowed their head forward. And I was with a friend of mine named Rod, who doesn't study animal behavior, and he was incredulous. I mean, we were both mesmerized, and as we rode off on our bikes, he said, "Wow, did you see that? Oh, I guess you see that every day." I had never seen it, but it was good that Rod was there. Not that I would embellish it or falsify it. It was good that Rod was there. He was moved as much as I was.
So anybody would be.
Mm-hmm. Once again, you know, if we do something, then it's possible that other animals do it, and we just need to keep the door open. I mean, the last 10 years has been remarkable in terms of what we've learned about other animals, and my God, I think the next 10 years is just going to be unbelievably rich in what we learn.
You've got a number of articles about zoos. How
Yes.
do you really feel about zoos?
Well, you know, I'm very honest to say I wish zoos would go away, but they're not going to go away anytime soon. I mean, there's practical matters. For example, you know, where are all the animals going to go? So my take on zoos is that we should give the animals who are living there, and they're basically forced to live there, the very best lives we can. And we need to really recognize, you know, that we can always do better. I think we need to get rid of some zoos, even some zoos that are accredited by the AZA, because they just don't have very high standards. And there's thousands of roadside zoos that have no standards at all. You know, they don't have to answer to anybody. And so, you know, I think that's what we need to do. And slowly but surely phase out the zoos and send the animals to sanctuaries. And in fact, Costa Rica just closed its two zoos and will be sending all of the animals to rehab sanctuaries.
Oh, yes, I heard that. And
yes,
that is so, so inspiring.
I mean, there's just a lot that can be done. And I think that, you know, when you take a dose of reality, zoos are not going to close overnight. But I really do think that there's quite a bit that we can do. And believe it, really, people are doing it. You know, more than six American zoos have phased out their elephant exhibits. I mean, elephants simply don't belong in zoos. So if you want to look at it that way, you can begin to sort of try to figure out which animals do better than others. But large animals like elephants don't do well in zoos, and major zoos are phasing out their elephant exhibits.
There's one article you have talking about killer whales and how at one exhibit there are people that are responsible for actually playing with Tilly's Willy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I just find so unbelievable, not just in a place like this, but we find it in animal agriculture where there are people that are highly educated, they have great credentials, and they're responsible for raping these animals or getting sperm out of them or inseminating the females. And who ever came up with this stuff?
Well, you're right. I mean, that was the Tilikum is the male killer whale at SeaWorld who killed some people years ago and then killed a keeper I think 2 years ago. And there's a new documentary that's been showing all over, and CNN has been showing it, called Blackfish, which is really it's a superb documentary, you know, about the ills of what happens at places like SeaWorld. The Tilly's Willy thing is just horrific, because what they do is they basically, you know, make the animal produce sperm, and then they use that sperm to make more whales and more whales who are going to live the rest of their lives in captivity and who will then be used to make more whales. And I call them whale mills. I mean, like puppy mills. And that's what they are. And so it's not surprising that a whale like Tilikum or Tilly gets really upset and, you know, harms or kills someone. It's a no-brainer that something like that is going to happen. And it's terribly sad. I mean, nobody's going around and saying, yeah, you know, look at this. This is what, you know, but we need to change our ways, Karen, really, really fast.
Yes. Now, of course, my passion is with food. This show is called It's All About Food. You have a section about animals and food.
Yep.
Now, I would want to believe that if we understood more about animals and understood their intelligence and understood that we are not superior, that we would be less likely to eat them.
Yes. Well, you know, I say in the book, and I always say when I give talks, that it's not a matter of what we eat, it's a matter of who we eat. And the reason I point that out is most food animals, or many food animals, are formerly sentient beings. And so I'm not saying that to be cute, and I'm not saying it to be antagonistic, but whenever I use that phrase and I talk to people, it's amazing how it changes their attitudes. And I had an email from a woman in Vienna, Austria, where I gave a talk 2 years ago, and I just mentioned, you know, it's who we eat, not what we eat. These are sentient beings who wind up at the end of a fork or on a, you know, a platter of pain. And apparently six people who heard my lecture slowly but surely became vegetarians. And yeah, and it really pleased me, not because I'm, you know, putting a feather in my cap, but it pleased me that it really made a difference to them when they started thinking about who, not what.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I'm very passionate about that, because I think for health reasons and ethical reasons, the way we eat and the choices we make can really, really have an impact on the lives of animals.
It's time. And you actually said that humans aren't really that bad.
No.
That we're more good than bad.
We are far more good than bad. We really are. I know people will always point to the bad, but I think that's because blood cells. You know, I mean, I've tried to get some newspaper or magazine, you know, articles out about goodness and cooperation, and we're learning that. There's psychologist Dr. Keltner at the University of California in Berkeley, who wrote a wonderful book called Born to be Good. And my book, The Animal Manifesto, is very much along those lines. He's dealing with human animals, on dealing with non-human animals. And more research is showing that, in fact, we are inherently cooperative and good. I mean, think of all the people you know, and I really mean that. I wish people would do this. You know, it's only a very, very few people who are nasty.
Yeah, but they have so much power.
Power. No, exactly. And that's the point I try to make, Karen, is that they have power, and we should harness our basic goodness when dealing with others. You know, I've been involved in this movement called Compassionate Conservation, and another book I had come out this year was called Ignoring Nature No More. And Compassionate Conservation stresses that the lives of every individual matter and that we are inherently kind, beneficent, empathic, cooperative, however you want to cash it out, and that we should harness that inherent goodness. And more research on humans is showing that that is the case. I'm so glad to discuss that with you because it really, really should move people to know that being nasty and being warlike is not natural.
War is not natural. And I think that's the best place to end because we're at the end of the half hour. Yeah, thank you. And I want to recommend not only do you want to pick up Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, but this psychologytoday.com/blog/animal-emotions is a great place. You could read the entries. They're short and very moving.
Thank you, Karen, and thank you, listeners. We will make a difference, I promise you.
Okay, that sounds good. Thank you, Mark Beekhoff.
Thank you, Karen.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been It's All About Food, and have a delicious week.